B. Collins.
Peter B. Collins, news and comment. It's Monday, May 6, 2019. A quick programming note. Your humble host is going to take a week off for a little travel inside the United States. I'll be away starting this Thursday and return a week from Friday. Over the weekend, several things developed. One is that Trump changed his mind about whether Bob Mueller should testify on Capitol Hill. And as if to wag the dog to distract us from the Mueller investigation and whether or not he will testify, late Sunday, I think it was during Game of Thrones for most Americans, John Bolton announced that a U.S. carrier group is steaming toward the Persian Gulf, based on a steaming pile of undisclosed intelligence. And today, Trump ramped up the trade war with China. And that's a form of wagging the dog, too, I guess. Where to begin with this unholy mess? Let's start with the carrier group steaming to the Persian Gulf. That would be the USS Lincoln and its related craft. And we're told that the White House and the Pentagon made the decision after seeing intelligence that showed new activity on the part of Iranian-aligned forces since last Friday. Now, this activity is taking place in Iraq. And by linking this U.S. ramp-up of tensions with Iran to the situation on the ground in Iraq, well, it complicates the presence of American troops in the ongoing U.S. occupation, even though it has been scaled way back. So we're not being told what the basis of this ratcheting up of tensions is. But Bolton said this is intended to send a clear and unmistakable message to the Iranian regime. You know they're bad when we talk about them as a regime. That any attack on United States interests or on those of our allies will be met with unrelenting force. He really wants a war with Iran. He always has. He added that the U.S. is not seeking war with the Iranian regime. But we are fully prepared to respond to any attack, whether by proxy, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, or regular Iranian forces. Now, this is on the heels of Iran signing a new bill that declared all American troops in the Middle East are terrorists, labeled the United States government a state sponsor of terrorism. And that, of course, is tit for tat, because the U.S., in a novel move, imposed economic sanctions and travel restrictions on members of the Revolutionary Guards of Iran. That would be the equivalent of declaring that the U.S. Marine Corps is a terrorist group and subject to sanctions by a foreign nation. And Vali Nasr, dean of the Johns Hopkins School, who is typically pretty supportive of U.S. government action, noted that the Trump administration has yet to put forward any clear evidence to support claims that Iran is planning a new attack on American forces in Iraq. And I have a quote highlighted here coming from Marco Rubio. He is a hawkish guy who loves to threaten and posture. On Twitter, where all the bullies go, he said, "We will not distinguish between attacks from Shia militias in Iraq and the IRGC that controls them. Any attack by these groups against U.S. forces will be considered an attack by Iran and responded to accordingly." So they are widening the pretextual conditions for a U.S. assault on Iran. And who would benefit most from that? That'd be Benjamin Netanyahu and the State of Israel. There is no direct, in my view, U.S. reason for military tensions or military attacks on Iran. So yesterday, after watching TV, our idiot president saw one member of Congress who was talking about setting up an appointment. This was David Cicilline. He is the Democrat from Rhode Island. And this didn't happen on NBC or CBS in their Sunday show, or ABC. No, on Fox News Sunday. Cicilline said that we hope the special counsel will appear, that nothing has been agreed to yet, but a working date of May 15th, next week, has been established. This led Trump to tweet, Bob Mueller should not testify. No redos for the Dems. Now, he's echoing comments that I saw in a video from a little hissy fit that Lindsey Graham threw. And he's now chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, and he said that he's not going to invite Mueller to testify on the Mueller report. It's over, he said. It's done. Case closed. Now, they are trying to use rhetoric and control of the agenda and spin to convince enough Americans that there's nothing to the obstruction charges in the second half of Bob Mueller's report. And as you know, I think that is the meat of the matter. I believe that Congress is duty-bound to begin impeachment proceedings against the president on the basis of obstruction of justice outlined in more than 10 instances in the Mueller investigation report. Now, notably, this is just Twitter posturing. We haven't heard the magic words executive privilege. That's what Trump would have to assert in what I think would be a failed attempt to block Mueller from testifying before House or Senate committees. But that won't mean that he won't try to stop it just by using the power of his tweets. And of course, as I pointed out, he is now more aggressive. He is emboldened. He actually believes his own phony claims that he's been exonerated. And in a moment, we'll get to the open letter from former federal prosecutors who say that if it weren't for the sitting president rule, that Trump is exposed to indictment for the obstruction of justice episodes that Mueller has described. But before we get to that, we have to open up another front, the trade war with China. When Trump got angry, irked is the word used by the New York Times because China is insisting that the U.S. quickly lift all of the tariffs if they do come to an historic trade deal this week. But Trump thinks he's being conned. He thinks he might end up on the losing end of this historic trade deal. And what does he do? He reflexively threatens. He bullies. And so he says he's going to throw even more tariffs on Chinese goods imported to the United States. And China is steamed. Now, as I have said before, China can't really be trusted in this kind of a negotiation. They will say whatever it takes, and from what we've heard about the documents that they've drafted to support the new trade agreement with Trump, it's all pretty vague. And I have had quibbles with Trump from the get-go. As you know, I'm not opposed to tariffs. I'm not opposed to, trade rules to try to protect jobs and industries in the United States. Many of those horses have not only left the barn, but they're outside the corral and up the road several miles. But fundamentally, I'm not opposed to protectionism by the United States. But this is not how to do it. China is a country that culturally relies on consistency. And by throwing these emotional, last-minute demands on these negotiations, I think Trump could break the whole discussion and lose big time. Farmers have lost. Tech companies have lost. This trade war with China is very costly to the United States. And yes, our job numbers are up, but wages aren't going up. And so we don't know if Chinese Vice Premier Liu He is going to lead the delegation coming to Washington today to resume these talks. So Trump threatened to raise tariffs by 25% this Friday and then tax another $300+ billion worth of Chinese goods sent to global markets. Now, stocks fell by more than 1% as the market opened, and I haven't had time to check how it closed today. Chinese negotiators had insisted that any concessions would need to be achieved through regulatory and administrative actions, not through changes made to Chinese law through its legislature. And that's the kind of tactic that China has used in the past. So, I believe this is a lose-lose situation. And I don't dispute that there are problems in the U.S.-China trade relationship. They often require our companies to give away intellectual property if they haven't already stole it. And, you know, there are many other issues of imbalance between the U.S. and China. But these are not the solutions to problems that we can acknowledge exist. So the House Judiciary Committee came up empty in its request to Attorney General Barr for the fully unredacted copy of the Mueller report. And Jerry Nadler is moving toward a 10 a.m. vote this Wednesday to hold Bill Barr in contempt of Congress. And as we've noted, this has only happened once before. It was to Eric Holder back in about 2012, related to the Fast and Furious case. And look what happened to Eric Holder. Not a goddamn thing. And this, of course, leaves me once again arguing for impeachment and complaining that as the Democrats dither, Trump is aggressively moving to cement his version of facts, the alternative facts, into the minds of tens of millions of Americans. And in the next day or so, I'll be releasing a recording of comments that I got from people on the street last Friday when I marched with others in support of Julian Assange on World Press Freedom Day. But the ignorance that we encounter just talking to average people on the street, Julian who? What's WikiLeaks? Draws a kind of mixture of sadness and contempt for a guy like me. So today was released a signed statement from 370 former federal prosecutors saying they believe that Robert Mueller's investigation would have resulted in obstruction of justice charges for Trump if he wasn't the sitting president. It was published on Medium this afternoon. The prosecutors have worked for both sides, Republicans and Democrats alike. A quote from their statement, "Each of us believes that the conduct of Trump described special counsel described in Mueller's report would, in the case of any other person not covered by the Office of Legal Counsel policy against indicting a sitting president, result in multiple felony charges for obstruction of justice. We emphasize that these are not matters of close professional judgment. Of course, there are potential defenses or arguments that could be raised in response. But to look at these facts and say that a prosecutor could not probably sustain a conviction for obstruction of justice, the standard set out in the Principles of Federal Prosecution, runs counter to logic and to our experience." And on the opinion pages of the New York Times today, Jimmy Reston is trotted out. I think he must be 90. He was writing op-eds for the Times back during the Watergate era. And he adds some interesting historical data here. July 30th, 1974, 9 days before Nixon resigned, the House Judiciary Committee added a third article to its impeachment charges against the president. The first two had dealt with obstruction of justice and abuse of power. Article 3 charged that Nixon had failed to comply with 8 congressional subpoenas related to the Watergate investigation. Obstruction of Congress. And Trump is practicing that right now. As we said, he hasn't formally said that he'll try to block Mueller from testifying, but he doesn't want his former White House counsel, Don McGahn, to testify, and he seems to be prepared to assert executive privilege, and it appears to be, to me, to be too late for that in the case of McGahn. And this also summons my memories of the Nixon limited hangout response to Watergate. And Reston addresses that, how Nixon went before the public and he was asked to turn over all of the Oval Office recordings that he had secretly made And instead, he handed over 33 transcripts of edited conversations that had not been subpoenaed by the committee. And he said, "This is the whole story." And that, of course, was the origin of the concept of limited hangout. And so, that's what we're up against today. And I question, is Trump daring the Democrats to impeach him? And are Democrats so afraid, so allergic, to exercise this constitutional power, which I freely admit may not lead to his removal from office because of the deadly loyal Republicans in the Senate? But I don't believe that outcome is a foregone conclusion. I think it needs to be tested. And I argue that even if it costs the Democrats the election in 2020, I think they are duty-bound to proceed with the impeachment route. They are mandated reporters to crimes that have occurred in plain view. Every day I pause for a second to thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. People like Susan Hornby Gavay. I often don't mention your middle name, Susan. It just popped out there. Evelyn Tyler just renewed her annual subscription. Carl Howard in Columbus and Jim Garrison here in California. They kick in a small amount of money each month, and you can do it too. All you have to do is drop by peterbcollins.com. You click on menu, then you pull down on become a subscriber. You land on the sign-up page, and it's easy. And I'd love to send you a bonus gift if you take out a new $50 annual subscription and give me a mailing address in the continental U.S. Your bonus book is a choice of Dr. Justin Frank's Trump on the Couch or the book 2100, A Dystopian Utopia with Blueprints for Climate Change Adaptation. And at the end of the podcast today, we have good news and bad news about climate change. Over the weekend, there were pretty significant exchanges between Palestinians in Gaza and Israeli military forces. Now, all this started on Friday with another of the protest marches, and Israeli snipers mowed down four Palestinians. On Saturday, the groups Islamic Jihad and allegedly Hamas fired some 600 projectiles on Saturday and Sunday into southern Israel. Now, we're told a couple of hundred of these were rockets, and the rest, I believe, was mortar fire. And while in the past, many of these barrages from Gaza have really been ineffective, you know, they fall in a field and nothing happens. Well, there were deaths reported on both sides. 9 militants and as many Palestinian civilians, including two children, were killed by Israeli forces on Sunday alone. And let me get the count here. A total of 22 Palestinians were killed, and 4 Israeli civilians died. And that's the unusual part. Israel pounds Gaza at will, and the loss of life is often significant. But rarely do Israelis die in the exchanges with Gaza. As of 7 o'clock this morning, local time, the Israeli military announced that all restrictions on public gatherings and they reopened the roads within a 25-mile radius of Gaza, as the Palestinians have said that Egypt has negotiated an initial ceasefire. And I hope it holds. I don't want to see any more loss of life. But Israel wants to wrap this up quickly because, after all, they have a big music festival coming up. They're trying to promote Israel as a destination for tourism. And we're told that after the month of Ramadan, which began this weekend, that Crown Prince Jared Kushner's peace plan is going to be revealed. And I think there's a lot of nervousness about that because I don't believe it addresses the interests of the Palestinians in any way, shape, or form. I'll be happily surprised if I'm wrong about that, but that is my guess so far. Last week, Miko Pellet published a piece, and he is the son of an Israeli general who is now an anti-Zionist Voice for Peace. And he raised an important issue. He quoted Bernie Sanders at the outset of his op-ed, "Palestinians are being treated extremely unfairly," said Bernie. And he says, "When we view what Zionists have done to Palestine," this is Miko Pellet, "when we understand the sheer magnitude of what was done to Palestinians, no term short of catastrophic seems appropriate." And this was triggered by watching a documentary film and then listening to a quote from Bernie Sanders. Now, Sanders, unfortunately, is one of the strongest voices of, calling for some moderation by Israel and raising at least fundamental issues about the Palestinians. The silence of others about this long-running conflict is criminal, in my view. But Sanders deserves to be spanked a little bit because just to say that it's unfair, Bernie, come on, you can do better. A couple of great stories published at the Gray Zone Report this weekend. They found a State Department document that was posted and then quickly taken down, bragging about the destructive influence of U.S. sanctions in Venezuela. The deleted page puts to bed any claims of Juan Guaido's independence from Washington, emphasizing that he announced his interim presidency in January. At the top of its section dedicated to breaking down key outcomes of U.S. efforts with regards to Venezuela. The document boasted that U.S. policy has effectively prevented the Venezuelan government from participating in the international market, has led to the freezing of its overseas assets. It reads like a sadistic celebration of Washington's retributions against the Venezuelan population as a whole, the kind of collective punishment that's illegal, according to the Geneva Convention. And Mark Weisbrot, who co-authored the report about some 40,000 deaths caused by the sanctions in the last 2 years alone, he said, "If I were the State Department, I wouldn't brag about causing a cut in oil production, which is a 36% drop, in just the 2 months of February and March this year. This means even more premature deaths than the tens of thousands that resulted from sanctions last year." And in Weisbrot's view, the policy and outcomes promoted by the State Department in the document that has now disappeared will lead to more cuts in imports of food, medicine, medical equipment, and inputs necessary to maintain water, health, and sanitary infrastructure. Then we have the real ambassador from Venezuela to the United Nations saying, "Imagine if any other country says it's proud of saying that we are destroying the economy of our neighbor. We are proud that we destroy the political system of our neighbor. We are proud that they are suffering. We are saying we are waging a war against Venezuela," he emphasized. And he said, "If any other person says that themselves, and you take that confession to court, they would be in prison." Also, Aaron Matei published a piece based on watching, as I did, Rachel Maddow's Friday night program on MSNBC. And Matei spares no diplomacy here. "The loudest voice among the corporate media hack pack, doubling down on Russiagate conspiracies, is MSNBC's Rachel Maddow. On May 3rd, she took her propaganda to an entirely new level of militaristic cheerleading, launching into a rant that offered de facto encouragement for the current neocon cause du jour, regime change in Venezuela. She not only cast Trump as a Russian stooge for daring to discuss the Venezuelan crisis with Putin, the top-rated liberal cable news host expressed sympathy for John Bolton and Mike Pompeo, the most militaristic members of the administration." Now, since the Trump administration launched its coup attempt starting in January, Maddow and other conspiracy theorists have done their best to ignore it. For one, acknowledging this brazen coup effort would show their hyperventilation about the Russian attack on our election to be a hypocritical farce. "It is far more difficult to liken stolen emails and juvenile Russian social media posts to Pearl Harbor or 9/11 when your supposedly defenseless country is openly trying to overthrow a foreign government via lethal sanctions." And the reason I stutter here is there's a lot of links between words that connect you to the underlying source that Matei is referring to. He goes on to say, Maddow has been a leading purveyor of now debunked Trump-Russia conspiracy theories, falsehoods, and innuendo. Looking back, I should have mentioned that Maddow's also been a vocal promoter of unhinged propaganda that encourages perilous tensions with Russia and cultivates pro-war opinion among her base of extremely suggestible liberal viewers. And the rant here was that in trying to make fun of Trump for talking to Putin, she then offered empathy for Bolton and Pompeo because their comments last week were basically undermined by statements that Trump made after talking to Putin. Another piece about Venezuela I want to recommend, it's a mid to long read. It's by Whitney Webb at Mint Press News. But she points out that it's not only American-based multinational oil companies that would benefit from regime change in Venezuela. Also, the investors in Monsanto, now owned by Bayer AG, a German company, could benefit because Hugo Chavez booted Monsanto's Roundup and its genetically modified seeds out of Venezuela back in 2004. And then Maduro signed the People's Seed Law in 2015. And one of the people who would benefit from this, according to the article, is the American Enterprise Institute and one of its single biggest donor, the vulture capitalist and billionaire Paul Singer. So he's recently upped his stake in Bayer, and regime change in Venezuela would not only help him because he would be part of the group that would refinance their debt, but he could get Roundup and the GMO seeds back into Venezuela. That appears to be his bet. Now, it also appears that he and other vulture capitalists are losing their bet, or at least part of it, on fleecing Puerto Rico. Because the government oversight board that I thought was toothless when Obama signed it into law has looked at the $123 billion debt of Puerto Rico and said that financiers illegally issued $9 billion of that debt, and it should be canceled. Fundamentally, there is a law in Puerto Rico that set a ceiling on how much debt they could take on, and that was exceeded with the love and humanitarian outreach of the vulture billionaires in New York. Even the New York Times notices strong similarities between Joe Biden's pitch for president this year and what Hillary Clinton used in 2016. They note that Biden's first fundraiser, hosted by a Philadelphia area donor who did the same for Hillary 4 years ago. Early policies embraced by Democrats, including Clinton, for years. A decades-long record in Washington, Hillary had a similar lengthy resume. And a tortured, drawn-out apology is the first controversy of the campaign? groping people and her email account, that's how they compare it. So I'm glad to see that they are picking up on just how idiotic it is to try to replay 2016 with an aging, baggage-ridden centrist like Joe Biden. And I was a little bummed out over the weekend. I'm on the Biden email list. They hit me 4 times a day. And this one caught my attention because the signature is from Simone Sanders. You remember her? The African-American woman who kind of joined the Sanders campaign in 2016 to bail Bernie out after he had a bad outing with some Black Lives Matter people in Seattle. Well, Simone writes, I'm on Team Joe because I trust him to get this right. I trust him to run a campaign that has standards and values and a commitment to win the White House. Can you chip in with your first donation today? Sorry, Simone, never. She went on to say, Joe Biden is a class act. He's unapologetically authentic and sincere. He's fought his entire career for working families and middle-class Americans, regardless of their race, gender, sex, sexual orientation, religious beliefs, or disability, and knows the immense pressure our country has to be a moral compass and is more than up to the challenge. Well, come on, Simone. He was the architect of the criminal justice reform that created that huge disparity between those convicted of possession of regular cocaine and those with crack. It was one of the most racist laws in its impact that we've seen in the last 25 years. And how you can gloss over that with this copywritten email supporting Joe Biden? I don't know, Simone. You lost me with this. Last fall, Florida voters approved by a 65% margin Amendment 4 to restore the voting rights of ex-felons in Florida. And now the Republican-dominated legislature with a Republican governor, a racist guy named Ron DeSantis, they're erecting new roadblocks to allowing ex-felons to vote. They're saying that they'll pass a law that if you're an ex-felon and you still owe money in restitution or court fees or almost anything else related to your incarceration, that you must pay all that off before you can vote. It's an ugly new Jim Crow poll tax. I am shaking my head. And finally today, a couple of stories about climate change, as promised. The bad news first, the IPCC, that's the UN Panel on Climate Change, issued a 1,500-page report today, and it tells us that as many as 1 million plant and animal species are now at risk of extinction. Now, the IPCC has been highly conservative. It's kind of peer-reviewed, and so the most significant claims are usually watered down. But even considering that, this is a very strong statement, and I will refer you to my recent interview with Guy McPherson, the climate scientist who says humans will be extinct by 2030. It is the most alarming and the shortest timeline of predictions that we have heard to date. And I'm hoping that Guy McPherson is wrong. But we know that warming has become a major driver of wildlife decline, and this study confirms it in very stark terms. Humans are producing more food than ever, but land degradation is already harming agricultural productivity on 23% of the planet's land area. And the loss of forests and coral reefs wetlands could expose up to 300 million people to risk of flooding. So one of the issues here that I don't see addressed in the report, they talk about transformative changes that include curbing wasteful consumption, slimming agriculture's environmental footprint, and cracking down on illegal logging and fishing. But they don't explicitly mention the methane output of cattle. And this is a significant issue. I confess I remain a carnivore. I eat beef once or twice a week. And I recognize that this is a direct threat to the reduction of greenhouse gas emissions. I don't know why it doesn't get mentioned in the report. But my former producer, Joshua Emerson Smith, who is now a really good reporter writing for the San Diego Union-Tribune, he posted a story today that the scientists at the Scripps Laboratory there near San Diego in La Jolla are working on a feedstock for cattle that is primarily made of seaweed. And if they can come up with reduced carbon ways to deal with the production of the seaweed, whether it's grown in the sea or on shore in water tanks with salt water, this could be a positive way of addressing the methane output from cattle. So I've linked to the story. You can pick up that link and check it out for yourself in the show file for today's podcast at peterbcollins.com. I thank you for listening, invite you to share this far and wide, remind you that it's available on YouTube, and I'm still Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.